This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. So glad you could be listening today. A few weeks ago, Oklahoma Senator and Chairman of the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, James Inhofe, took to the Senate floor with a snowball to demonstrate why he thinks climate change is a myth. This week came the news that Florida's government reportedly banned its employees from using the terms climate change or global warming in its official documents.
Here at home, public health officials in Milwaukee are encouraging people to get their children vaccinated against measles in the face of an outbreak that's caused in part by large numbers of people who don't believe that vaccines are safe. And it was a couple of weeks ago when Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker spoke to members of the international media and declined to answer whether he believes in evolution.
It's a challenging time for scientists, especially those who look to the public to fund and support their research. But how did the divide over science open up in this country? It's a situation that interests Andrew Petto. He's a senior lecturer in science education, evolution education, and anatomy at UW-Milwaukee, and he's on the board of governors for the National Vaccine Education Project. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mitch.
How do you see the divide that is open in this country over science? What does it look like to you?
In one sense, it looks like the culmination of a bunch of cultural phenomena that we have seen going way back into our roots of individualism, mistrust of centralized authority, mistrust of elites, and to some extent to the mistrust of academic elites in particular. We want to do it for ourselves. We want to see it for ourselves. And one of the remarkable things is that every year in our introductory course, we have our students go through a case study, which is about how do we do science and how do we find out whether something is acceptable or not. And one of the questions we ask them at the end is, well, tell us something that would give you more confidence in your assessment of whether these scientists did a good job or not. And about 25% of them say, I would be more confident in the result of this research if I could do it myself, if I could participate in it. And it's not an unusual response. And then we point out to the students that there are 15,000 clinical trials a month in this country that are registered with the federal government. And I don't know how many other bits of research there are out there, but it's clearly impractical for us to get our confidence in science only because we have done it ourselves. So we have to understand the process a little bit better. And that really is on us at the university to do a better job of getting that point across. Now, the next generation science standards are meant to try to bring that understanding as a part of general science education.
Is there a general misunderstanding of even what science is set up to do, do you think?
In one sense, yes. We see this also in some of our political leaders and their expectation that the purpose of science is technology. The purpose of science is to make something better for us, Tang or computers, or it's worth spending all of that money to go to the moon if, as a result of that, we get something tangible out of it. And so this is sort of what we expect. We confuse the aims that certainly science does have a practical application in many cases. But really the foundation of this is a better understanding rather than anything practical. Naturally, a better understanding will give us practical things that work. But we tend to think about Thomas Edison as a great scientist. Well, he was a great inventor. And he figured out how to apply the science in lots of things. So I think that's part of it.
Well, and so why do you think the gap has opened where people – on one hand, have trust in science when it meets their needs, but are skeptical of science when it doesn't. I mean, have scientists and the scientific community made mistakes that essentially open the door to the skepticism that exists today across ideological lines?
Well, I'm not sure it's so much a mistake as the actual nature of the process of science. I mean, the fact is that many of our favorite things that we know today, like continental drift, for example, were roundly rejected by the scientific community in the beginning and for quite some time until the appropriate evidence and the appropriate understanding was made available and could be applied to the problem. So part of the problem is really a problem of authority. That is, we scientists have made a big deal about the fact that science is revisable. Science can be tentative, can be changed when new information comes along. And we get into an issue with, well, how is that authoritative? If you guys are going to change your mind, you know, in 60 years, why should we believe you now, especially when it contradicts the experience that we have? I mean, global warming, the weather around here has been unusually cold for the last several weeks, and it's going to come again. And that's the question that people ask. And you know, it's some of the things that we talk about in science are counterintuitive. They don't match people's immediate experience.
Well, so how would you recommend that we evaluate science when it does contradict what our experience is if science changes from time to time?
That is probably the essence of the understanding of science. And again, when we're looking at the next generation science standards, what we're looking at is to get people to understand the process better. Part of it is not helped by the fact that every time a university professor publishes a paper, somebody in the PR department puts out a press release. And we had an article a couple of years ago, Eric Meikle and I, and it was that whole issue. You know, you see when a new fossil appears, it changes everything we know about evolution. Well, the fact is it almost never does. And that was a point of our article. We had looked at human fossils and we had said, you know, when was the last time a human fossil discovery changed absolutely everything we knew about the history of our species? And we couldn't find one. And the fact is that in overview, that's very, very well understood. It is true that we get some details that change because those are things that are unknown to us. There are some things that we can't know. If we discover a fossil that's 6 million years ago that we have never seen before, it's new evidence and that needs to be evaluated. But the fact is that if we've done science well, what we have is a large perspective that helps us to see where things fit. And the details are the things that are much more likely to change over the long run. So this kind of idea of the lone scientist who makes a discovery that turns the entire universe on its head is wrong. It's a very rare phenomenon that such a thing happens, but there are some really great things that happen. The first vaccination, for example, was a really great thing, and it probably affected the outcome of the American War for Independence because George Washington, I am told, wanted his troops vaccinated against smallpox, whereas the British didn't. That gave them some line of resistance to one of the things that used to kill warriors more than anything else, which was disease. So there are big events in science, for sure. And those are things that help transform our understanding. But they transform our understanding more than they transform the evidence that we have.
There are some who say that this is not an issue of putting more facts out there, that there are lots and lots and lots of facts, but this is an issue of trust in people as much as it is trust in statistics.
Rather than use the trust word and the belief word and all of those kinds of words, it really is more confidence in the reliability of the process, that this is a way of untangling complicated things to help us understand them. And if we do it right, then it helps us to predict things that we have not yet seen.
How much of an issue do you think is the idea of confirmation bias?
Confirmation bias is one of those things that we admit is a problem that other guys are having.
And I feel like by asking this question, I have some amount of confirmation bias.
You know, what we do is we collect data and we begin to look at the data and we begin to see patterns. You know, humans do that. They see patterns in lottery numbers. They see patterns in things that really don't have any strong pattern.
This is why people are hypochondriacs.
That's true. And so one of the things that that we see as we do that is we make a decision in the process of doing research what is worth looking at and how we should look at it. And so the way that we check that and the way we should check that is this whole peer review process where you get anonymous people who can look at your stuff and they can tell you all the things they think are wrong with it. And then you can have, you know, an argument with them about it sometimes. And this is a process we all go through. It was probably the most frustrating part of publishing anything in the sciences because you'll have all these people telling you, you know, what's wrong with what you did. And the process of fixing that is really part of the process of combating this confirmation bias. So you're much more likely to see it in those press releases because the, you know, the PR person at the university is just listening to what the scientist says, and he says, "Well, I've just, you know, I've just saved the world, and this is, you know, brand new discovery that's going to change everything." Most likely, you're not going to see that in the article that comes out in Nature or the Journal of the American Medical Association. It's going to be much more conservative in terms of its inferences, but it's just who we are as people. And I think that's partly the tension that we have between this is a human endeavor. It's science is a human endeavor, and it is imperfect.
At the same time, confirmation bias exists among lay people as well. And there are some who say this is exactly why issues like vaccination and climate change are such flashpoints, because people find the science that supports what they believe.
It reminds me of when I was just finishing college many, many years ago. I lived with a family in Vermont, and the grandmother lived with them. And Granny Lavoie, every morning, would take down a rusty nail and put it in her tea and brew her tea with a rusty nail. And she said that was so that she didn't have iron deficiency. Now, there was no way to explain to Granny Lavoie that the particular form of iron that was in her rusty nail was probably not doing her any good physiologically, but Granny Lavoie had never had iron deficiency anemia in her 97 years of life. But the idea is that, you know, we have these experiences that we relate to certain things, and if they're not harmful, then certainly they cause no harm. Nothing terrible was happening to Granny Lavoie from the rusty nail in her tea, so that's great. Maybe nothing good was happening either, but, you know, that's confirmation bias. With vaccines, you know, what's interesting is we just had a conversation, or it's ongoing right now in the listserv that I share with the science teachers, particularly biology teachers around the country. And we're seeing there a lot of anecdotes about a niece or a nephew or a son or a daughter who was, quote, perfectly fine and then had a vaccination. And then a couple of weeks later, people started noticing certain kinds of developmental defects. And they don't form a particular pattern. It isn't necessarily autism or ASD. It is a variety of things. And one of the issues with that is that what we see is, you know, an event, and then we see another event, and the tendency we have is to put them together and say one causes the other. The fact is that the developmental schedule for the immune system that we use to figure out when to give the vaccinations and the developmental events that allow us to detect certain types of neurological and cognitive disorders are pretty much in parallel with each other. So for many of these children, you wouldn't be able to detect the cognitive changes that are associated with something like autism before the time that we do. And it happens to be very close to the time when we give the injections. So the science behind that is pretty solid. The problems that we have seen, for example, in the outbreak of measles at Disney really has to do with the fact that there's a large group of children not vaccinated, and that means that whenever they get together and get exposed to the disease, there is a relatively large pool that will allow this disease to be spread, and that's how we get these epidemics. And the issue really is, on an individual basis, parents are very worried, and it's what we do as parents. You know, the most tragic thing is for something to happen to our kids. We would all rather die than have something terrible happen to our kids. And so if there's something to worry about, we worry about it. And one of the things that we see with all vaccinations is that there is a known risk for a variety of things that can go wrong with a child that's vaccinated. And so we have a certain level of encephalitis, of brain inflammation, with the MMRV that we give for measles, mumps, German measles, and chickenpox. And we also have a level of that same complication with children who are infected naturally. And when you look at the CDC data and the World Health Organization data, the rate at which these brain inflammations happen just for measles is 125 times higher than for the four virus vaccines that are included in that one shot that the kids get. The piece that came out in the New York Times a few weeks ago looked at vaccination rates in California and found that there were some communities in which the percentage of unvaccinated children was close to 50%. And that, which we have normally associated with poor immigrant populations coming in from the third world, from Asia, from Africa, this is Marin County. These are affluent, well-educated people. This is putting their children at greater risk of harm than if they had them vaccinated, as if they should ever become exposed to measles. You know, that's the thing that we don't know. That's the unknowable part of this.
Well, it is all food for thought. Andrew Petto, thanks so much for helping us break through some of these questions.
Always a pleasure, Mitch.
Dr. Andrew Petto is a senior lecturer in science education, evolution education, and gross anatomy at UW-Milwaukee, and he's on the board of governors for the National Vaccine Education Project.
A quick break now, and then a preview of the new production at the Florentine Opera, Elmer Gantry, on stage this weekend. Keep listening. It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.